Journalist Barry Esterbrook takes us around the country on an investigation into America's methods of producing the other white meat in his new book, Pigtails, an omnivore's quest for sustainable meat. He is our eyes, ears, and nose that travels from industrial pig farms and slaughterhouses to sustainable farms in Missouri, as well as in our region, where he discovers how pigs can be raised without constant use of antibiotics in their feed. In fact, he visits with Michael Yazzie on his farm on the banks of the Battenkill River in Shoshone, New York, in Washington County. Esterbrook raised pigs in Ontario in another life and starts his investigation by asking why the pork at the supermarket does not look or taste like pork from a private farm. Barry Esterbrook is a former contributing editor at Gourmet magazine. He is also the author of Tomato Land, a book about industrial tomato agriculture, and he blogs at politicsoftheplate.com. It's a great pleasure to welcome Barry Esterbrook and Michael Yazzie to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. Very nice to have you here.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Joe.
Again, Barry, tell us how you came to the story of, as I mentioned in the introduction, of saying, okay, why does this meat look different than the meat I'm used to? And I guess it starts there.
Well, yeah, the whole book project started when I ate a pork chop, an incredibly good pork chop. I didn't know pork could taste that good. I'd been eating the industrial other white meat for the past 15 years. And this was from a heritage breed that was raised by Mike Yazzie here on pasture. And two things were happening that don't happen with industrial pork. First of all, it was a heritage breed. It wasn't a cookie-cutter thing just bred to grow fast. The second thing was being on pasture means you get to move. And if your muscles move, they actually turn red, for one thing, and they take on flavor. So those two things were what set this apart from what you get at the supermarket.
The subtitle of the book is An Omnivore's Quest for Sustainable Meat. Talk a little bit about the quest, of ultimately what you wanted to find out.
I wanted to find out, you know, everything I could about pigs, the animal. I figured, well, if you're going to eat an animal that's an intelligent animal, and you want to know what's going on. So the first part of the quest was just talking to researchers about the nature of pigs. There, you know, I knew, like most people, that a pig is smart.
Yeah.
I had no idea how smart pigs are. Researchers at Cambridge University showed that they're as smart as three-year-old children. They've been taught to play computer games and get quite good at them. They have a sense of what's called a sense of self, which until recently people thought only humans and maybe the great apes had. So they're an incredibly smart animal. And then you take this animal and you place it by the thousand in factory-like buildings where they get no sunlight, no fresh air. Their hoofs never touch ground. They're on cement grates with their feces just fall through into pits underneath them. You feed them all manner of animal byproducts, keep them on low doses of antibiotics all the time, and that's what you get from an industrial pig versus a sustainably raised pig, where the animals are outside exercising they roll in the mud, they have societies, they have friends, pig friends, and they exercise all of their essential pigginess.
I want to bring Michael into this conversation in just a moment, but before I do, let me just ask you about the idea that when did we start to come to this reality of pork?
The industrial pork?
Yes.
It began in the 60s and 70s and really took hold in the mid to late 80s. So it's a relatively new. You know, pigs have only been raised this way for a few decades. And it started when pig farmers got bigger. And they realized that if they're going to get bigger, then they have to start building bigger buildings. And you build a big building, you might as well build a huge building for, you know, economies of scale and things like that. And it just kind of followed this industrial pattern without any consideration the fact that these are animals and they're very intelligent, sensitive animals.
Michael Yezzi is featured in the book Pigtails, and Barry, you talked to Michael for the book. Michael, give us a sense of what brought you to Washington County, what brought you to say, okay, I want to raise pigs.
The area was important to the family, and the farm in next door to the property came up for sale, and a developer bought it and wanted to carve it into house lots. And this was a farm that had been in farming for a couple hundred years and was also part of a very scenic part of Shushan. And you know, folks walked down the road all the time to enjoy the views. And we thought that losing this to development rather than keeping it in its historic use of agriculture would be a loss for the whole area. And so we decided that we would step up and purchase the property, even though we weren't in a very good position, just being in grad school, but purchased the property and then worked to renovate the house and put in some sweat equity. And then once the house was done and we moved in, decided to focus on the outside, which was sort of a challenge because it was always tempting to get outside and do the projects out, but had to have some place to live first. So talked with some people who had helped us with the renovations and neighbors and looked at all things from bees to buffalo and settled on pigs because we both had off-farm jobs and needed to do something where we didn't have to milk twice a day or have to, we didn't even know if we'd be any good at farming. So waiting 2 years to raise beef seemed like a risky proposition. So somebody said, well, get some pigs. You get them in the spring, you get rid of them in the fall. Not a big investment, some fencing, a shelter. Said that bacon's, you know, one of the four major food groups. So we thought it was worth a try and got three pigs and didn't wind up killing them early. So decided to expand the next year, and 14 became 57, became 120, and did about 1,000 pigs last year.
Wow. 1,000 pigs. So, and that, do you see that right now as probably being as high as you'll go?
That's starting to push the limit for the farm, you know, 1,000, 1,200, something like that. And now it's time to sort of work on optimizing it between the various outlets, mail order, farmer's market, restaurants. We also raise meat chickens and laying hens.
So for an outsider looking in, Barry, describe a little bit what makes Michael's operation so unique.
Well, you know, if you go, first of all, you go into one of these industrial pig barns. Michael raises 1,000 pigs a year. I went in to visit a guy in Iowa who raises 150,000 pigs a year, one farm. And, you know, the first thing is you walk into what looks like a changing room down at the gym, stripped nude, both of us. It's quite an experience. I don't think I'd have ever had that happen at an interview. And then you march through a shower and you shampoo and shower and come out the other side on the clean side where there's clothes and you know, underpants, socks, clothes waiting for you. And then you enter this barn and the smell is something that one, you know, it's ammonia, it's dung, it's decay. And it's so thick that your eyes, you know, it hits you like a physical. It's like getting hit with warm water almost. And you see these, the growing pigs are kept in little pens about 20 by 20 maybe. And there'd be 20 or 30 piglets that would live their life in that pen. The worst part is the sows, the breeding females. And I went into one barn where there were over 1,000 of these magnificent, huge animals. And they spent their entire life in cages, which were too small to even accommodate them. They certainly couldn't turn around, and that was their whole life.
So counter that to the experience that you get when you went to Michael's.
Well, you go to Michael's, and you start out with those sows, and they're lolling around a nice field where there's shade, there's trees, there's a mud hole, They have lots of room closer to the time they give birth. Typically, they're brought into a large barn where each sow has a comfortable stall to have her baby. She has material where she can make a nest, which is a huge instinct with pigs. And then when you see the pigs growing up, they're running around the fields, racing around the fields, and the fields are half, usually half field, and then a percentage of woodland, so the pigs can scamper up into the woodland. They have little, looks like miniature Quonset huts.
Mm-hmm.
And 6-10 pigs will pile in those if it's cold or if it's rainy. But they're rooting, they're running, they're playing with each other. It's totally different. And it doesn't smell.
Mike, what is it about your operation that changes the taste? I mean, I assume Barry was talking about antibiotics, was talking about the feed and so forth. So what is it that you do or do not do that allows that taste to be so improved?
There's a few things that I think influence that. First is the breed. These are rare heritage breed pigs. So heritage pig varieties of pigs that were around 150 years ago. Rare heritage pigs, there's pigs around 150 years ago, but worldwide populations of between 2 and 5,000 of the breeding stocks. So by contrast, a Duroc, which was started in Saratoga and Washington counties in the 1860s, is one of the main production breeds. So of the 120, 130 million pigs produced in the United States each year, a good number of those are Durocs or have Duroc genetics. And the large black, the Tamworth, the Gloucestershire Old Spot, the Ossabaw have worldwide populations of breeding stock of between 2 and 5,000. So it's this older variety of pig that hasn't had all the fat and flavor bred out of it. They're eating good, clean food, just ground corn and soy and some minerals. And they're foraging, so they're eating grass and rooting, and they have free choice food and free choice well water. And then they're outside, so they're rooting. It's a low-stress natural environment. They're able to move about. They spring, summer, and fall, we rotate them through pastures so they can root, they can graze, they can sleep in the shade, they can play and run around. They can tussle with other pigs and establish their pecking orders. They can get away from ones. So it's that low stress, I think, that has a lot to do with the flavor.
And Barry, what would you say about that, of what you think makes such a difference?
Well, I'd say it's exactly that, because a pig on one of these confinement barns can exercise precisely none of its natural impulses, none. It can't root, it can't socialize normally, it can't. Mm-hmm. And secondly, these pigs have been bred primarily to grow very fast and efficiently, period. That's the hallmark of an industrial pig. And that creates very thick muscle fibers. If you have a pig that's growing that fast, the muscle fibers are thick. A heritage breed grows much more slowly and develops fine muscle fibers, so the meat is intrinsically different, in addition to the exercise and all of what Michael spoke about.
As I mentioned, the subtitle, An Omnivore's Quest for Sustainable Meat. You identify yourself as an omnivore. I'm an omnivore. But I asked the question, because I realized there are people asking it right now, which is, okay, but in either case, the pig still ends up dead.
Well, That's an ethical question,
right?
And I think we all have our own systems of ethics, and I certainly respect. But the fact of the matter is, 86% of Americans eat pork at some time or another in the course of a year, according to the Pork Board. And I think we can all agree that if you raise pigs so the animals are comfortable, that the animals enjoy their full pig life, that is way better than to keeping them in these hideous confined things where they're their mind, they go insane, their minds don't work right, they so that's my take on it.
And I found in my experience personally and talking with customers is that when you have a pork that has more flavor and the fat, it's more satisfying. And because we're more land and labor intensive by moving the pigs around, our pork is more expensive. And what we do to with our customers is we encourage them to buy less, and they do buy less because when they eat it, it's more satisfying. They can have a half a pound or a third of a pound of a pork chop and be happy with that and be satisfied and get other vegetables at the farmers markets. And they don't need to get the 16-ounce steak and still be wanting more afterwards. That the fat is more satisfying.
Do you think, Barry, that we'll ever reach a point where this sustainable approach will be the norm?
Well, I think that we'll reach a point where large-scale pork producers will be vastly different than they are now. And I think we'll reach a point where sustainably raised pork will be an option that almost anybody can opt for. I mean, 10 years, when I first had my first heritage pork chop, it was you almost had to know somebody who was raising this stuff. And now, you know, up and down all around this area, it's quite easy to get really well-raised pork. So I think that the two things will come together. I think there's certain practices the industrial guys are going to have to fix. They're horrible polluters. And then this whole system of abusing antibiotics.
Which is interesting, too, in Michael's story, in that you're on the banks of the Battenkill River. So when it comes to the pollution aspect, I mean, obviously, this is something that you have to be especially concerned about.
It is, and we've thought about it. I think about it quite a bit, and done a lot of planning to address the issue: where we put the pigs, how long we put the pigs, how far they are from the banks, and what sort of vegetated buffers we have. All depends on, you know, distance and slopes, and what time of year it is. And we've done great efforts to make sure that we're not polluting the river. And by rotating the pigs, we've actually turned what is in the industrial world a waste problem and turned it into fertilizer. So as Barry said, the farm doesn't smell, and that's because we're rotating the pigs around. So there isn't a concentration of manure. They spread the manure themselves in their pens. And then once they've, you know, grazed it over and chewed it up with their feet, then we move the pen, and the manure that they've put down there and the food they've dropped and the bedding they've pushed out of their huts will all be used as organic material to help regenerate the grass and prepare them for the next round of animals to go on there, whether it's the chickens or another round of pigs.
Realizing that in mass, often farmers are not the most optimistic group of people that you'll ever meet, but I do ask the question of, you know, can while doing this good, can you make a living at it? Is it sustainable for you?
It's been a long road, but it is a living, and I've been doing this full time for 11 years. It's not a lucrative business,
right.
But you know, I live in a beautiful place on the banks of the Battenkill. I have great. The pigs have some of the best views in the world,
as they should,
and which I think they only benefit. The pork only benefits from. And so I have a great quality of life, and my kids have a great quality of life in the farm and living in this area. Fortunate enough to be within 3 hours, 3.5 hours of New York's biggest city, as opposed to, say, South Dakota's biggest city.
Right.
So I'm able to do this because of the location I'm in, but I'm fortunate to have great customers in New York City, restaurant customers, farmers market customers, who appreciate the product and are willing to help support what's needed to produce it.
So when it's all said and done, Barry, what do you hope people get out of the story, out of the book that you're telling?
I hope that they try, if they haven't, really well-raised pork once. And the stuff that Michael sells and all this other well-raised pork should have a warning label on it that says, warning, once you've tried this, you're not going to be able to eat the other white meat because it's so good. everything else aside, you'll realize that what you've been eating has not been pork.
Well, the name of the book is Pigtails, An Omnivore's Quest for Sustainable Meat. The book is published by Norton. Barry Esterbrook is the author of the book. Michael Yezzi is featured in the book, his farm and the practices that we talked about just a moment ago. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you
very much. Very nice to have you here. And Barry, thank you very much and best of luck with the book.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Great pleasure. Again, Barry Esterbrook's new book is Pigtails, A Omnivore's Quest for Sustainable Meat. It's published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.